The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today we're reading from the August 19th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week, it reminds me of that old board game called Battleship. There's a blue flat surface with grid lines on it. Looks like the ocean. There's a big aircraft carrier and several battleships, all in a line heading towards a little map of Taiwan on the board with looks like the leader of Taiwan standing there. There are airplanes flying through, and it looks like bombs have been dropped. The headline is, Standing Up to China. Did Beijing's angry leaders just rehearse their plans to invade Taiwan? And that'll be our second main story, but we'll start with the first one. Democrats' victory on climate health care bill. What happened? President Biden and Democrats were on the verge of a major legislative victory this week as a $430 billion package focused on slowing climate change and lowering health care costs headed for the House after clearing the Senate on a party-line vote. It marked the culmination of over a year of negotiations between the party's progressive and centrist factions that whittled down a far more ambitious $3.5 trillion package, and a dramatic turnaround for a bill that seemed dead just weeks ago. Now dubbed the Inflation Reduction Act, it was revived by an 11th-hour deal between Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer and Senator Joe Manchin, who balked at the size of the previous bills. Fellow centrist Senator Kyrsten Sinema signed on after insisting on removing a provision that would have raised taxes on hedge fund and private equity executives. Cheers erupted in the Senate chamber as the bill passed 51-50, with Vice President Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi promised swift passage. It's been a long, tough, and winding road, but at last, we have arrived, said Schumer. The bill includes an unprecedented effort to fight climate change with $370 billion in green energy tax credits that are projected to cut carbon emissions 40% from the 2005 levels by 2030. The bill also will set a $2,000 annual cap on out-of-pocket drug payments for Medicare recipients and lower drug costs by allowing Medicaid to negotiate some prices. The Republicans blocked a measure that would have capped insulin prices at $35 a month for those with private insurance. The bill will pay for itself, raising an estimated $739 billion in new revenue over a decade by strengthening IRS enforcement and setting a 15% corporate minimum tax on large firms. Some $300 billion will go to deficit reduction. Republicans said the package would hurt an already contracting economy by raising taxes. The package neglects Americans' true priorities, said Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, solutions for inflation, crime, and the border. What the editorial said. This landmark bill will have a real impact on Americans' lives, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. It will fight warming and move us toward green energy through incentives that won't destroy the economy. It will lower drug costs for struggling seniors, create a fairer tax system, and lower the deficit. So why didn't a single Republican vote for it? Their sole twisted goal was to deny Democrats a win, even if the legislation would help their own constituents. Voters should remember that in November. Democrats can take their victory lap, said the Wall Street Journal. But don't think this ballyhooed legislation will have any meaningful impact on the climate. The truth is that any modest efforts we make to stem emissions will be dwarfed by what the rest of the world does. And Democrats can do nothing to stop China, India, and Africa from burning fossil fuels to grow their economies. What the columnist said. This bill is a big effing deal, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. It's a shame Manchin and Sinema cut out so much, but this legislation restores government's role in promoting the common good. By passing it, Democrats have embraced an economic populism from which there is no turning back. Every dog has his day, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post, and apparently so does every miserably inadequate president. But let's remember that this bill is a shadow of Biden's initial package, which was larded with everything from free community college to paid family leave. This bill's emphasis on windmills and electric cars amid spiking inflation shows Biden's disconnect from the concerns of ordinary Americans. Biden has defied expectations, said Margaret Talev and Elena Treen in Axios, with a run of legislative successes from the Infrastructure Act to expanding veterans' benefits, he's earned a legacy as a president who got big things done with a deeply divided Congress. Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri is dead, gas prices are falling, and job creation is soaring. Whether it will help Democrats in November is another matter, especially since most of the bill's effects may not be felt for years. Still, the much-maligned Biden has proved to be one of the most legislatively successful presidents of the modern era, said Ryan Lizza and Eugene Daniels in Politico. In less than 2 years, he shepherded through nearly $3.5 trillion agenda, making significant progress on the pandemic, broadband access, roads and bridges, drug prices, gun safety, climate change, and tax equity. Much of it was significant Republican support. His original pursuit of FDR-like ambitions with the slimmest congressional majority was like trying to pass a rhinoceros through a garden hose. What he got through was more like a pony, but it's still pretty impressive. And a second shorter main story. China menaces Taiwan with live fire drills. What happened? China this week continued its largest ever military exercises around Taiwan, punishing the island for hosting U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Calling Pelosi's visit last week malicious and provocative, Beijing unleashed a barrage of missiles, some flying directly over Taiwan and landing in Taiwanese and Japanese waters. For 4 days, it conducted a simulated blockade of the island with live fire drills involving some 200 planes and 40 ships. And then it began a round of anti-submarine and sea assault exercises. In addition to staging the ongoing military display, China said it would put sanctions on Pelosi and her family. It also suspended talks with the U.S. on climate change, drug trafficking, and other transnational issues, and closed some communication channels between its military and the Pentagon. During her day-long stay, Pelosi had a sit-down with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, and she praised Taiwan and its 23 million people as an important bulwark of democracy in the region. The Chinese foreign minister said that meeting gravely undermined China's sovereignty and territorial integrity, adding that while peaceful reunification with Taiwan was preferable, we will not renounce the use of force. President Biden had questioned the timing of Pelosi's visit, which took place as Chinese President Xi Jinping prepares to seek a third term at the Chinese Communist Party's Congress later this year. But he said he was not worried by China's military response. Pelosi, for her part, said Xi was simply acting like a scared bully. What the columnist said. Pelosi should have known better, said Douglas Schoen in The Hill. Biden administration officials didn't want her to antagonize China right now because they are seeking to persuade Beijing to stop funding Russia's war machine. She thumbed her nose at the administration and went anyway. And her senseless self-promotion will only bring Beijing and Moscow closer. Yet once China objected and began issuing threats, Pelosi had no choice but to go ahead with the trip, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in an editorial. To cancel would have looked like the U.S. was buckling to the demands of an authoritarian nation. China has grown only more bellicose on Taiwan since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Whatever the consequences ultimately are, and China shows no signs of ending its military harassment of the island, Pelosi's trip demonstrates that the U.S. won't be cowed by the world's bullies. The crisis over Speaker Pelosi's visit is just the beginning, said Hal Brands and Michael Beckley in the Wall Street Journal. U.S. intelligence officials warn that Beijing is mulling an attack on Taiwan within the next 5 years, possibly even in the next 18 months. Yet while Washington has rightly spent tens of billions of dollars to help Ukraine, it struggles to find a fraction of that to shore up U.S. and allied military strength in the Pacific to deter the Chinese invasion. We're running out of time to avert what could well be a cataclysmic war. Controversy of the week is abortion, what the Kansas referendum reveals. The voters of Kansas just rewrote the script for the midterm elections, said Daniel Strauss in the New Republic. In a referendum last week, Kansas voters rejected a proposal to strip abortion protections from the state constitution and empower lawmakers to pass a sweeping ban on the practice, as other red states have done since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Both sides had predicted the vote would be very close, but the resounding vote margin, 59-41% in a state that twice voted for Donald Trump, and a massive turnout suggest the existence of a hidden army of voters who are going to make reproductive rights the issue of these midterms. The Kansas landslide is the strongest evidence yet that overturning Roe may backfire politically on Republicans, said Annie Linsky and Katie Shepard in the Washington Post. Other states will also hold referenda on abortion this November, including Michigan, Kentucky, and Montana, and pro-choice Democrats are feeling a surge of optimism. It shows the motivation to vote is super strong on our side, said Michigan Democratic Senator Jim Ananich. No doubt about it, the Kansas vote was bad news for pro-lifers, said Ramesh Poniro in National Review. But the left is giddily overreading what it portends for November. Anyone hoping to see similar groundswells of pro-choice sentiment in deep red Tennessee, say, or Mississippi, will be disappointed. Besides, the turnout in Kansas was driven by a specific proposal about one issue, abortion, which won't be on the midterm ballot in most states. Come November, said Philip Bump in the Washington Post, voters will again be choosing between candidates with positions on a large range of issues, including the economy, inflation, and government spending. Are voters going to be energized to turn out to vote for a random Democratic House candidate simply to backstop abortion rights? No one knows. Democrats now have a huge opportunity, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The key to the massive victory of the Vote No campaign in Kansas was a brilliant TV ad that framed the issue in libertarian, almost conservative terms, calling on Kansas to reject government control of their reproductive choices. Tapping into the widespread resistance to government mandates can be broadly effective at a time when Republicans nationwide are mounting increasingly audacious assaults on American freedoms, banning books, censoring history, and making it harder to vote. Democrats should now rebrand themselves as defenders of your constitutional rights in your doctor's office, at the library, or in the voting booth. It's a winning message. It will be if pro-lifers continue with their near-absolute ban, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Kansas shows that voters don't want the loony and vicious abortion laws that some red states are imposing, with no or very limited exceptions for rape, incest, and the life of the mother. Polls have long shown that on abortion, most Americans stand in the middle, wanting it to remain legal, but in favor of restrictions beyond, say, 15 weeks. When you turn it into a question of all or nothing, you'll likely get nothing. Nevertheless, here we all are, finally tackling this gnawing national problem through the messy process of democracy. It will get ugly at times, but this is America working it out. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for motorists after gas prices continued falling for 57 straight days, reaching an average national price of $4.01 per gallon, down a dollar from mid-June. It was a good week for alarm systems after Fred Everett of Mississippi was awakened at 2:30 a.m. by his cat, Bandit, who was frantically scratching his arms to alert him that two burglars had invaded his home. After scaring the intruders off, Everett called Bandit his guard cat. It was a good week for taste after Domino's Pizza closed the last of the 29 restaurants it opened in Italy, ending a seven-year effort to sell its Americanized version to Italians. The chain cited stiff competition from local mom-and-pop operations. But it was a bad week for Cracker Barrel, the iconic Southern restaurant chain, which received famous furious blowback for adding meatless sausage patties to its menu. "You just lost the customer base," said one typical commenter. "Congratulations on being woke and going broke." It was a bad week for furry friends after Representative Lauren Boebert warned that if Democrats ban assault-style weapons, America will need to eat dogs. "In Venezuela, they eat the dogs," Boebert explained, "and it started because they don't have firearms." Finally, it was a bad week for staying connected after an Apple iPhone fell from the pocket of Pittsburgh Pirate rookie Rodolfo Castro as he slid into third base. "It's horrible it happened to me," said Castro, who claimed he forgot to take the phone out of his pocket before the game. We're on the briefing page, titled this week, "The Search for More Effective Vaccines." The coronavirus that causes COVID is mutating rapidly and evading immune defenses. Can the vaccines keep up? Are COVID vaccines still effective? Without question, but vaccines aren't producing the ironclad immune defense they did initially. Unvaccinated people are still about five times more likely to catch COVID, seven times more likely to be hospitalized, and roughly 14 times more likely to die, according to new data from the Mayo Clinic. But the hypercontagious BA5 subvariant of Omicron, now the dominant strain in the U.S., is four times more resistant to COVID vaccines than the original Omicron variant, and breakthrough infections have become commonplace. Effectiveness against hospitalization is dropping over time, especially among people over 65 and the immunocompromised. As a result, the Biden administration scrapped plans for a summer booster campaign and instructed Pfizer and Moderna to tailor boosters to BA4 and BA5, and those tweaked vaccines are expected as early as mid-September. The White House also recently convened scientists who are pursuing two potential game changers: an inhalable nasal vaccine that could dramatically curb transmission, and a universal coronavirus vaccine that could protect against all variants. Ultimately, we need vaccines that can protect us no matter what Mother Nature throws us, White House COVID response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha said. Why is vaccine efficacy fading? COVID is constantly evolving, and BA5 has changed dramatically from the wild-type strain that first emerged in Wuhan, China. Pfizer's and Moderna's vaccine strain train the immune system to target the coronavirus spike proteins, which latch onto cells. But the spike proteins are one of the fastest mutating parts of the virus, and the original Omicron variant featured dozens of spike protein mutations. For people who'd received two vaccine doses but no booster, vaccination effectiveness against hospitalization fell to 61%. The Centers for Disease Control found, and against Omicron subvariants, the effectiveness rate dropped to 24%. Moderna needs about 6 months to test and develop variant-specific vaccines, and new variants have emerged during the pandemic roughly every 4 to 6 months. The result is a frustrating game of whack-a-mole. Many people are getting COVID twice or three times, sometimes just weeks or months apart. New infections in the U.S. may be running at more than 750,000 a day. There are about 3,000 deaths a week, or 150,000 a year, and those numbers may surge in the fall and winter. What's the solution? Scientists have high hopes for nasal spray boosters, which could be key to limiting infections. The current mRNA-based vaccines, injected into a muscle, induce strong immunity in the blood, preventing severe illness, but appear to cause a more limited immune response in the airways where the virus enters the body. A nasal vaccine could stimulate an immune response in the mucosa, the tube lining that runs from the nose and mouth to the lungs and stomach. Nine existing vaccines work along these lines, using oral drops to protect the mucosa against diseases such as polio and the flu. More than a dozen COVID nasal sprays are being developed worldwide, and animal tests show promise. The hope is to shore up defenses in the nose so that the virus can't replicate in the nose, said Dr. Ellen Foxman, an immunobiologist at the Yale School of Medicine. That would be like the Holy Grail. Is a vaccine against all variants possible? Dozens of vaccine developers think so. The most ambitious of these universal coronavirus vaccines would target commonalities across the coronavirus family, providing long-term protection against COVID, future variants, and strains in bats and other animals that could jump to humans and cause future pandemics. Researchers at the California Institute of Technology and the University of Oxford produced a vaccine containing parts of spike receptors from eight coronaviruses, including COVID, MERS, and SARS. In monkeys and mice, the vaccine provided broad protection. Another pan-coronavirus vaccine developed by Army researchers has entered Phase 1 human trials. But full clinical trials could take several years, and there's no guarantee these ambitious vaccines will work. what's slowed vaccine progress. The sense of urgency is completely gone, said Dr. Florian Kramer, a virologist at the Icahn School of Medicine in New York City. Starting in 2020, Operation Warp Speed spent $18 billion to help scientists and pharmaceutical companies accelerate development of COVID vaccines, which were produced in just a year. Federal funding for new vaccines is less than $50 million, and Republicans in Congress have blocked additional COVID funding all year. Vaccine developers say they're struggling to find appropriate volunteers for trials, and there's even a shortage of monkeys and mice for testing. From day one of this pandemic, we have never tried to get ahead of the virus, said Dr. Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute. The initial success of Pfizer's vaccine was 95% against symptomatic COVID, Topol said. This virus is vulnerable. We've proven that. We're just not building on our successes. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. Anti-vaccine nonsense is spreading. Vaccine skepticism is like a deadly virus, said the Washington Post, and it's killing people as it spreads across the U.S. and the world. Even before the coronavirus hit, the anti-vax movement had taken root here, fueled by a debunked paper that falsely linked vaccines with autism in children. During the pandemic, anti-science cranks and far-right libertarians served up a dangerous cocktail of doubt, suspicion, and fear about vaccines, insisting that mandates designed to fight a deadly infectious disease violated their medical freedom. Today, many Americans, particularly Republicans, exhibit a general hostility towards science and medical expertise. While 89% of Democrats trust the CDC, for example, just 41% of Republicans do. That mistrust kills. Scientists estimate that 200,000 American lives would have been saved if everyone eligible for the COVID vaccine had gotten it. And the death toll will only grow as disinformation spreads and people reject other vaccines. In Florida, for example, at least three candidates running for seats on the nine-member board that controls Sarasota Memorial Hospital are vaccine skeptics. The truth is that vaccines have proved to be safe and effective, and that means freedom from death and suffering. Trump's many gifts to Democrats. If you're a Republican who hates seeing the Biden administration pushing through lots of big spending progressive legislation, said Zachary Faria, you can blame Donald Trump. The Senate is 50-50 mainly because Republicans lost both Georgia runoff elections in January 2021 when Trump was still throwing a temper tantrum over his defeat in November. He told Georgia voters that their elections were rigged, discouraging them from voting, and in campaign appearances virtually ignored the Republican candidates while berating Republican state officials for not overturning the election. With many disgusted Trump voters staying home, Democrats pulled a shocker and won both races. If not for Trump, Joe Biden would have entered office with a 52-48 Senate that would have stymied most of his plans. That Trump fiasco followed the disaster of the 2018 midterms, when the then president's failure to stay on message enabled Democrats to flip 41 House seats and take the majority, the party's largest gain since Watergate. In 2020, widespread disgust with Trump put an uninspiring Biden in the White House. As the Democrats spend trillions and fill federal courts with progressive judges, they ought to send Trump a thank you card. This column comes from Russia. The extremists sent to fight in Ukraine. Russia has lost tens of thousands of troops on the front lines in Ukraine, said Sylvia Stober. But the Kremlin doesn't want to risk a domestic outcry by calling up its reserves to replenish the ranks. Instead, our investigation has found Moscow has been recruiting contract soldiers from the prison systems and from far-right militias who are lured with higher-than-usual pay. The Defense Ministry has been drawing on the networks of Wagner Group, the paramilitary force led by an ally of Vladimir Putin that has become notorious for torturing and killing civilians in Africa. Wagner recruiters have lowered their standards to supply cannon fodder for Ukraine. Now, not even drug tests are carried out before duty. The Russian military has even partnered with explicitly neo-Nazi militias based in St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown. Those include the Russian Imperial Legion, an ultra-nationalist, white supremacist paramilitary group that the U.S. lists as a terrorist organization, and Russia, which uses Nazi symbols, Rusich, which uses Nazi symbols, and whose leader boasts of being a proud Nazi. Russia, of course, used the denazification of Ukraine as a pretext for its brutal invasion, but the accusation is completely unfounded. The real Nazis, it turns out, are on the Russian side. The last word, our feature article, training teachers to shoot back. Some teachers hope learning to use a gun will protect their students from active shooters, said Sarah Mervosh in the New York Times. Will arming teachers make schools safer? Mandy, a kindergarten teacher in Ohio, had already done what she could to secure her classroom against a gunman. She positioned a bookcase by the doorway in case she needed a barricade. In an orange bucket, she kept district-issued emergency supplies, wasp spray to aim at an attacker, and a tube sock to hold a heavy object and hurl at an assailant. But after 19 children and two teachers were killed in Uvalde, Texas, she felt a growing desperation. Her school is in an older building with no automatic locks on classroom doors and no police officers on campus. We just feel helpless, she said. It's not enough. She decided she needed something far more powerful, a 9mm pistol. So she signed up for training that would allow her to carry a gun in school. Like others in this article, she asked to be identified by her first name because of school district rules that restrict information about employees carrying firearms. A decade ago, it was extremely rare for everyday school employees to carry guns. Today, after a seemingly endless series of mass shootings, the strategy has become a leading solution promoted by Republicans and gun rights advocates, who say that allowing teachers, principals, and superintendents to be armed give schools a fighting chance in case of attack. At least 29 states allow individuals other than police or security officials to carry guns on school grounds, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. As of 2018, the last year for which statistics were available, federal survey data estimated that 2.6% of public schools had armed faculty. The count has probably grown. In Florida, more than 1,300 school staff members serve as armed guardians in 45 school districts, out of 74 in the state, according to state officials. The program was created after a gunman killed 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland in 2018. In Texas, at least 402 school districts, about one-third in the state, participate in a program that allows designated people, including school staff members, to be armed, according to the Texas Association of School Boards. Another program, which requires more training, is used by a smaller number of districts. Participation in both is up since 2018. And in the weeks after the Uvalde shooting, lawmakers in Ohio made it easier for teachers and other school employees to carry guns. The strategy is fiercely opposed by Democrats, police groups, teachers' unions, and gun control advocates, who say the concealed carry programs in schools, far from solving the problem, will only create more risk. Past polling has shown that the vast majority of teachers do not want to be armed. The law in Ohio has been especially contentious because it requires no more than 24 hours of training, along with 8 hours of recertification annually. That, to us, is just outrageous, said Michael Weinman, Director of Government Affairs for the Fraternal Order of Police of Ohio, the state's largest law enforcement organization. By comparison, police officers in the state undergo more than 700 hours of training, and school resource officers, police assigned to campuses, must complete an additional 40 hours. Supporters say 24 hours is enough because while police training includes everything from traffic tickets to legal matters, school employees tightly focus on firearm proficiency and active shooter response. Studies on school employees carrying guns have been limited, and research so far has found little evidence that it is effective. There is also little evidence that school resource officers are broadly effective at preventing school shootings, which are statistically rare. Yet arming school employees is gaining appeal, finding slight majorities among parents and adults in recent polls. Of the five deadliest school shootings on record, four in Newtown, Connecticut, Uvalde, Parkland, and Santa Fe, Texas, have happened in the past 10 years. It was the possibility of another that brought Mandy and seven other educators to a gun range tucked amid the hayfields and farm roads of Rittman in northeast Ohio. Over the course of 3 days, Mandy practiced shooting, tying a tourniquet, and responding to fast-paced active shooter drills. Her presence on the range, firing her pistol under the blazing sun, cut a contrast to the classroom, where she dances to counting songs with five-year-olds, dollops out shaving cream for sensory activities, and wallpapers her classroom with student artwork. That she was being trained at all spoke to the country's painful failure to stop mass shootings and to the heavy responsibilities piled onto teachers, catching students up from the pandemic, handling mental health crises in children, navigating conflicts over the teaching of race and gender, and now, for some, defending their schools. Mandy, in her 40s, arrived at the training with nervous anticipation. She had been a teacher for a dozen years and has children of her own. She wanted to be sure she could carry her gun safely around students. "I get hugs all day long," she said. And then there was the prospect of confronting an actual gunman. Could 3 days of training prepare her for the unthinkable? The educators had come from Ohio and as far as Oklahoma for a 26-hour course by Faster Saves Lives, a leading gun training program for school employees. It is run by the Buckeye Firearms Foundation, a Second Amendment organization that works alongside a major gun lobbying group in Ohio. The lobbying group, the Buckeye Firearms Association, supported the new state law for school employees. Over the past decade, the foundation estimates it has spent more than $1 million training at least 2,600 educators. Its approach aligns closely with an argument that has become a hallmark of the National Rifle Association and the gun lobby. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, In this view, teachers are the ultimate good guys. We trust them with our kids every day, said Jim Irvine, an airline pilot and longtime advocate for gun rights, who is president of the Buckeye Firearms Foundation and volunteers as a director with FASTER. The philosophy is that saving lives during school shootings is a matter of speed and that schools cannot afford to wait for the police. At Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown in 2012, the first 9/11 call was made after about 5 minutes, and the first officers arrived at the school less than 4 minutes later. Still, 20 children and 6 adults were killed. In Parkland, the gunman killed 17 people in just under 6 minutes. Even in Uvalde, where the police have been criticized for waiting on site for more than an hour, the gunman is believed to have fired more than 100 rounds within the first 3 minutes, according to a state report. Time is all that matters, Irvine said. It's that simple. Of the 8 school employees being trained, Mandy was in some ways an anomaly. She was the only woman in the group. Several others were administrators, a superintendent, a principal rather than teachers. In other ways, she was typical. Everyone had some comfort with guns. Mandy described hunting with her husband and shooting at a gun range on weekends. She said she had taken other firearms classes, including concealed carry training, one of the prerequisites to participate in FASTER. Like others, she worked in a rural area where carrying guns in school is more common, in part because of longer response times by police. One group in the training from Oklahoma estimated the response time in its area was at least 22 minutes. The last thing I want is for people to think we are a bunch of gun-slinging teachers who want an excuse to carry guns in schools, said Mark, a middle school teacher in Ohio who described measuring his school's hallway to determine how far he needed to learn to shoot. I love my kids, he said. I'm going to do everything I can to keep them safe. School districts typically require anonymity as a tactical and safety strategy so that would-be gunmen cannot plan around armed employees. Although the school community may know someone on campus has a gun, employees and parents will not be told who. That makes the choice of candidates especially crucial. We don't always consider an individual that's like, hey, jumping up and down, said Malcolm Hines, an assistant superintendent in Suwanee County, Florida, where armed employees must pass a psychological screening and complete 144 hours of training. My spidey senses always go up on that, if someone is too eager. In Mandy's school district, the superintendent and candidates must be approved by the school board. In addition to going through the FASTER training, they must meet annually with the sheriff's department and may be removed if their skills are not up to par. At the FASTER program, much of the training focused on firearm proficiency. The group practiced shooting for hours, up close and far away, right-handed and left-handed, small circular targets and life-size human silhouettes. I want to be perfect, Mandy said, noting that accuracy would be paramount if she ever needed to fire her gun in school. Instructors offered safety and technical critiques, timed individual shots, and urged teachers and administrators to be assertive. All of it was aimed at one thing, stopping a gunman in the act. By the end of the program, Mandy, who scored 28 out of 28 in FASTER's shooting test, and her classmates had enough training to carry a gun to school under the new law. They are part of a growing and somewhat experimental stealth force in schools. The outcome is far from known. Although there have been anecdotes of armed citizens intervening in public shootings, such as the recent case at an Indiana mall, that is an anomaly, said Jacqueline Schildkraut, an associate professor of criminal justice at the State University of New York at Oswego, who studies mass shootings. Most mass shootings end when a gunman is shot or subdued by police, dies by suicide, or leaves the scene. Faster officials said they were not aware of any graduates of their program who had responded to a school shooting. Jennifer, a school custodian who volunteers as an instructor with Faster, said that in 4 years of carrying in her school, she had never needed her weapon. She does not doubt her ability, she said, but believes the hardest part would be using her firearm on a student. She recalled a time when a middle schooler she had been mentoring threatened to bring a gun to school. My heart just dropped, she said, adding that administrators were able to intervene. For Mandy, the decision to be armed in the classroom seemed like a better solution than wasp spray or a tube sock. She has worked through logistical details, such as how she will carry her pistol inside her waistband in a holster meant to prevent accidental discharge. She did handstands to check that her gun remained secure. When students came for hugs, she plans to turn her hip to direct them to the other side of her body. To keep up her training, she goes to the gun range each week, she said. And although she acknowledged that other important policies could help prevent school shootings, she did not feel she could afford to wait for the change. We've got to help the kids right now, she said. A version of this story originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's a health and science piece. All known proteins mapped. In a breakthrough that could sharply accelerate drug development, the artificial intelligence company DeepMind has deciphered the structure of almost every protein known to science. Proteins are the building blocks of life, and their function is determined by their 3D structure. Once that structure is known, scientists can understand how the protein works and how to change its behavior. Until recently, such modeling was expensive and time-consuming, so scientists had identified the shapes of only a fraction of the 200 million or so known proteins. But in November 2020, DeepMind, owned by Google's parent company Alphabet, announced that its AlphaFold program could predict the shapes using an algorithm. Since then, it has been crunching the genetic codes of every organism that has had its genome sequenced and describing the shapes of the hundreds of millions of proteins within them. The work has already proved fruitful. Researchers have used the models to help them understand a key malaria protein and to engineer new enzymes to break down plastic waste. The new database is a gift to humanity. Ewan Burney from European Molecular Biology Laboratory's European Bioinformatics Institute tells New Scientist, 2 years ago, we just simply did not realize that this was feasible. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page with a couple of articles here. Jones, a conspiracy peddler's reckoning. The truth scored a sweet victory in a Texas courtroom last week, and a monster faced his comeuppance, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, host of the notoriously noxious website InfoWars, was ordered to pay nearly $50 million in damages to the parents of a child killed in the 2012 massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Jones has spent years claiming that the tragic shooting, which killed 20 children, was a fabricated false flag scheme to justify gun control laws. In searing testimony, the grieving parents described the harassment and death threats they received from Jones' deluded followers, which they said made their lives a living hell. A squirming Jones was forced to admit that the shooting was 100% real, and now this malevolent huckster will finally suffer real consequences for leveraging the pain of others to make a buck. Things may get even worse for Jones, said Charlie Sykes in MSNBC.com. In a dramatic courtroom moment, the parents' lawyer revealed that Jones' lawyer had inadvertently sent him 2 years' worth of Jones' text messages, which appeared to catch Jones in numerous lies. He may now face perjury charges, and he will soon have to pay damages to other Sandy Hook parents who've won two additional defamation suits against him. Jones' moment of reckoning should serve as warning to other conspiracy peddlers, said law professor Joanne Sweeney in NBCNews.com. Nefarious sites like Newsmax and Breitbart likewise use their platforms to spread outlandish theories with impunity, from rigged voting machines to Democratic pedophile rings. Perhaps Jones' fate will make some of them pause before hitting the publish button. Don't bet on it, said Kevin Roos in the New York Times. The Jones verdict is unlikely to curb the phenomenon he represents. Belligerent fabulous building profitable media empires with easily disprovable lies. Jones has made a fortune spreading his conspiracy theories and selling quack cures and treatments. An expert court witness put his worth between $130 and $270 million. InfoWars DNA has entered the conservative bloodstream, as evidenced by GOP Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene's claim that a recent mass shooting in Illinois was staged to create support for gun control measures. The grim truth is that Jones' shtick is everywhere these days, and his legacy of brazen, unrepentant dishonesty will live on. Climate change. Is it already 2050? It's been a summer of disasters, said David Wallace Wells in the New York Times. Punishing heat waves and historic floods are leaving absolutely no doubt that climate change is here. Nearly 6,000 temperature records were broken in the U.S. last month, with severe heat waves punishing the Pacific Northwest, the Southern Plains, the South, and the Northeast. Floods battered St. Louis, which recently got 2 months' worth of rain in the space of 6 hours. And 1,000-year rainstorms also hit Illinois and eastern Kentucky, where at least 37 people died in massive floods. Drought-plagued western states, meanwhile, are fighting over water cutbacks from the starkly depleted Colorado River, while wildfires rage in California. In Europe, temperatures over 100 degrees killed more than 2,000 in Spain and Portugal, and another 1,000 people in the usually temperate United Kingdom. A few years ago, heat and storms this extreme were projected as a worst-case scenario for 2050, but they're arriving as prophesied more than two decades early. The world is ill-prepared to handle our punishing new climate reality, said Dinah Voice Pulver and Dora Rice in USA Today. Fierce heat, prolonged droughts, and extreme storms and floods will have a brutal effect on daily life, human health, the workforce, and transportation. It's already so hot that outside workers often can't do their jobs for days at a time, costing the economy billions. In the U.S., heat kills more people annually than any other extreme weather event, far more than tornadoes, floods, and hurricanes, said Denise Chow in NBCNews.com. And in coming years, the frequency and severity of extreme heat events will only get worse. The sad thing is, we might never have a summer this cool again, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. That means developing robust plans for dangerous weather, especially to protect the elderly, disabled, and poor. Wildfire-prone western states will need to reevaluate their forest management strategies, while low-lying coastal cities and states may have to install massive barriers to hold back waters as sea levels rise. Reducing greenhouse gas emissions is critical, but in the short term, we need to take steps to deal with the climate change we've already caused. The heat is on, and we have no choice but to stay in the kitchen. And we've just time for a few of the short notes. Firearms used in crimes in states with strong gun restrictions are often brought in from states with loose restrictions, such as Georgia, Texas, and Florida, federal data shows. In Massachusetts, 79% of the guns connected to criminal investigations came from out of state in 2020, up from 63% in 2015. The number of Americans without health insurance hit a record low of 8% at the beginning of the year, according to an analysis by the Department of Health and Human Services. More than 5 million people have gained coverage since 2020, the department estimates, due to expanded premium subsidies and increased outreach to help people enroll in Obamacare plans. There were 20 separate weather and climate disasters in the U.S. last year that caused at least $1 billion in damage, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Over the previous four decades, the country averaged 8 such disasters per year. And we've got time for two quotes. The first from Mason Cooley. A happy arrangement. Many people prefer cats to other people, and many cats prefer people to other cats. And from the famous Carl Reiner, if you're not on the obituary page, eat breakfast. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.